From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Christopher Newfield says there's a disease in public higher education in this country, a cost disease. You've got tuition going up and up and up. You've got student debt that's at crazy levels. And then you have this funding model that's shifting away from public money to the private sector. And the problem is, well, you can see what the problem is. All of that money is not delivering the same education it used to. Students are learning less. Newfield is a scholar. He's a professor who's been trying to figure out what happened, and he's written a few books to explain it to the rest of us. He says about 3 decades ago, government officials and college administrators started treating public universities like businesses, and he says it's not working. He's joining us today to take us through what happened. His latest book is called The Great Mistake, after the news.
Hey, Benjamin Bombard here from Radio West. All this month, we're asking a favor of you, our listeners. Tell someone, anyone, about a podcast that you think they might love. Tell your mom, tell a friend, tell your dentist, tell someone who might not even know what a podcast is. Anyway, help spread the podcast love. Easy way to do that, hit the share button on your podcast app. It usually looks like a half-finished triangle with the 3 dots. And use the hashtag tripod, that's try with a Y. Thanks for doing that. Thanks for listening. And here's the show.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For a number of years now, Christopher Newfield has been trying to figure out what is ailing public higher education. And you know what he means by ailing? High tuition costs, massive student debt, stagnating educational benefits. It's complicated, but one of the things that happened about 30 years ago or so is that university administrators and public officials started thinking of colleges as businesses, submitting them to the standards of a market. And it made sense, at least it seemed to. Newfield says the thinking went something like this. Public funding and public sector thinking was making higher education leaden and bloated and inefficient, and that if you just exposed a university to the dynamics of a market economy, you'd get more innovation, you'd get better teaching and research, and these schools would be self-sustaining. So public institutions started raising money in the private sector. They created these corporate partnerships. They promoted online learning. But now, 3 decades on, Newfield says we can see the results, and they're not good. Treating universities as businesses, he says, hasn't made them more efficient or hasn't increased their wealth. In fact, it's increased their costs. And even more of a problem, it's shifted money away from the core of what a university is supposed to be about: self-development, democratic citizenship, sustainable economic development. Today in the program, Christopher Newfield is joining us to explain not necessarily why we got here, but how, and how we get back on track. His latest book is called The Great Mistake: How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. Christopher Newfield is a professor of literature and American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's written several books on this subject. He's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in London, where he is currently conducting research. And Professor Newfield, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, Doug.
I want to begin with something you say in your latest book, in The Great Mistake. You say that for something like 25 years now, you've had this front row seat at this effort to make the public university more like a business. And I wanted to hear you talk about those, when those initial efforts were proposed. Were you skeptical? Were you one of the skeptical ones? Or was there a time when you thought, oh, this might make sense, this could work for us?
Well, there was a long time when it seemed like you could just add up the different revenues, right? So you could you'd have public money, and then you would bring in this additional private money. So you'd bring in research funding, you'd do more fundraising with philanthropists, you'd, you know, hit up your alumni for donations after the football team had a particularly good season, and everything would, you know, would work better. And I just had direct experience of it not really helping the overall community of the university. So with philanthropy, you could endow a center for autism, which did great work, but it didn't really help the university around it, like the education school. And as I started to look into this and, you know, wondering why things were narrowly targeted and what was going to happen to the subjects like, well, you know, just teaching in general that weren't susceptible to fundraising, I began to realize it wasn't actually just neutral and, you know, good for those things, but neutral for the university. It was actually taking resources out of the overall university.
Is that when you started – when did you first start writing about all of this? This is your third book, and you've done a number of articles.
You have this massive blog. Myself. Yeah. Well, it's – I was – you know, I'm from the basically the 19th century. That's what my original field of expertise is, and I was interested in corporate culture and how that was changing the way that people dealt with each other in universities. But it was – you know, it started with the – really with looking at the impact that it was having on my own teaching, on my own students, on the kind of resources that we had available just to do the actually really difficult work of getting ourselves to learn new things, which is hard, and to have new ideas, which is even harder, to change our minds about things. So it started in the late 90s, early 2000s, and then I had really good luck with getting on some academic senate committees where I was very well mentored by folks that had a lot of experience with planning and budget. So for a lot of the 2000s, I was on committees that most people find boring, like they find spreadsheets boring. But for me, this was really telling a story about the back office of the university. There's a story that the bookkeeping told that I wanted to bring to the public because I don't think that most people understand how it works. And that for me, the stakes are the stakes are the answer to the question, why does college cost so much?
Yeah.
And then the second stakes are the answer to another question, which is, are our children really learning in university? Those two things are connected, and the book is about, you know, explaining why it costs so much and what's actually happening to teaching and research as a result.
Go back to, I think this was 2005, when you were on an academic senate, and you write about this in the book, and it started to dawn on you that there seemed to be some kind of shift away from, I think, this thinking about the public good to a private good.
Yes. Well, it has to do with this thing called technology transfer. Yeah. I mean, I'm basically a private school kid. I went to Catholic schools. I went to a great Jesuit high school in Los Angeles. My parents had gone to public universities. They were first generation college in Southern California. And they, you know, they wanted me to have a more sort of intimate experience. And so I went through college and then I went through graduate school in the private system. I got my PhD from Cornell, which has some public units but is mostly private. And then my first job was at Rice University, which is a really wealthy boutique, kind of lovely school in America's most underrated city, which is Houston. If anyone's listening there, it's okay. A fabulous place. And then I got a job at UC Santa Barbara, and I was coming back to California where I'd started. And I was really excited about the core mission of public universities. And that is to take, as I see it, the quality that we give to elites who go to Stanford and Yale and give it to everybody that is qualified to go, you know, just based on basic success in high school. So we're not just talking about the 1% or even the 5%. We're talking about 10 to 15% that go to the University of California. And then the idea of the public system was, and this is very much how my parents got going in life, is that, well, even if you didn't do that well in high school, there are other places for you. There are second chance places that are just as good. The quality, they're doing slightly different things, but the quality is really high.
Yeah.
The genius of the public system in the U.S. was that the quality is the same at different levels. It's not just everything goes to the Ivy Leagues and everything else is second rate, third rate, fourth rate. It's democratic. At least that's how I saw it.
Yeah.
And so I was very excited to go to the University of California because I thought, okay, so these are students who are not excluded from great higher education because they're not in the top 2%. You know, my Rice students all had 750s on each of their SATs.
Right.
They're going to be students that are more mixed. They have different backgrounds. They have different experiences. They're racially diverse. And I was thrilled that I was going to be part of this. And then when I started to go into these meetings, it was about 10 years after I started my job that I was doing system-wide, where I was going to Oakland once or twice a month. What surprised me was we were losing our confidence, you know, our enthusiasm in our public model. And we were basically imitating a language that was coming from places like Stanford. And I think that story that you're talking about is when I was in a meeting about technology transfer policy, about the university's relationship to businesses that use our patents and so on. And the person who was speaking for the public good of putting a lot of intellectual property into society for free, not charging for it, not licensing it exclusively and so on, was the woman from Stanford.
Yeah.
And the University of California people on the public sector really, really wanted to do exclusive licensing and were asking a whole bunch of questions about how can we make more money out of our IP. And that seemed to me to be backwards.
Yeah.
It was the public side that should be saying, let's put it into the public realm. Taxpayers paid for it. And let's keep doing the science and the research behind that. And, you know, other folks will do something with this work, you know, in the public sphere.
What's interesting is you say that a large part of this problem are these, and we'll get to these as we go, but they're these key economic and cultural assumptions. And I want to ask you about the cultural part of this. You're a scholar of culture. What are the cultural assumptions that we've been mistaken about over the past, you know, 25, 30 years?
Well, one of them is that the business sector is more efficient yeah. than anything in the public sphere. And unfortunately, we are making that true by underfunding everything in the public, so it's kind of not as good, right? But that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It doesn't have to be that way at all. So that's one issue. The second is that you can't trust people to do a great job on their own. You've got to pressure them. You have to subject them to competition, or they're going to slack off. They're going to laze around. They're going to do the minimum. They're not going to do the kind of job that you want. So we've moved a whole lot of public services and public goods onto a private business model that doesn't work for them. We can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
And we've also increased the costs of administration and management by requiring a whole bunch of checks and auditing, and basically an elaborate mechanism of mistrust on a national scale that assumes that people have to have someone else looking over their shoulders and basically evaluating their keystrokes. You know, hasn't gotten to that in the university, but we could be getting there. Or they're not going to perform in the way that we want them to. So when you have low trust, you have higher costs. And when you have... what that does inside of the institution is it leaches confidence out and makes people less great, you know, just makes them less able to, you know, to do the best job possible because they don't have the levels of, you know, confidence and even arrogance and excitement that they would have if they thought that they were respected and their institutions were respected and everything, you know, is going to turn out well because, you know, we all care so much.
Do you think privatization, if it doesn't work in the context of higher education, you know, submitting higher education to market forces doesn't necessarily mean that it won't work in other contexts, right? Or do you think there's a broader economic message here that maybe the assumptions we've made about the private sector don't necessarily work even in subjects that might surprise us?
Yeah, well, the part of the private sector that is about management, I think, is grossly overrated. That's really more about control than it is about efficiency. So that's the thing I just mentioned.
Yeah.
But there's another piece of this which, you know, we associate with the market, and that are, you know, price signals. And those are useful. They just don't they're very useful around commodities that we don't see as being absolutely necessary for human existence. You know, if you don't have an iPad, as I think one of the representatives from Utah recently pointed out, it's not as important as not having health care.
Right.
So, but we have this other category of goods. We have shelter, we have food, we have health care, and I would put education in this bundle because we devolve as a society as we are seeing now rather quickly if we don't have fairly stable educational systems to, you know, enlighten us and keep us moving forward. And what the here's the problem with the market with this. It allocates resources according to ability to pay. That's the one sentence problem. With public goods, we want to allocate resources on ability to benefit. And when I say ability to benefit, I mean the individual benefiting in a whole bunch of different ways, both in terms of market goods, but a lot of non-market ways. And also we want the society to benefit. So the basic idea of a public good or something like a public university is that you pay for it with tax dollars because you, the whole society, benefit. And it's vastly more efficient to pool the costs across the whole population of your state rather than just requiring the immediate students who are actually in school right now in these 4 years and their families to bear at least half and now going on to be most of the cost of their educations. It's inefficient from a social point of view, and it's inefficient from a whole range of non-market goods to subject those to market forces. The wrong people get a lot. I mean, good people get way too much, you know, like the students at Stanford that have been trained from the age of five to be great in school, and they go and they get $100,000 a year showered on them, versus the people who go to the community college like Danza down the road that can barely find chairs for its classrooms, where a student will get three, maybe four, maybe $5,000 a year. So, if it's all about your ability to pay, then that's fine because Stanford's a lot more expensive and then you're getting a lot more out of it. But if it's education and it's a general benefit, not just about your higher salary, but about your society and about your whole quality of life, your whole personal development, then it's, from my point of view, grossly unfair, but also grossly inefficient to use market structures to allocate like that.
One of the points you make in the book, and you've made in, I think, in all of them, is that universities are not doing a very good job making the case for the public good of education, and that we're talking about these things differently. There's this scholar, William Rainey Harper. I'm trying to sort of peg his time frame, from the University of Chicago.
Yeah, late 19th, early 20th century.
Right. And he says this. In the grandest terms, he talks about the importance of education in the humanities. Democracy has been given a mission to the world, and it is of no uncertain character. I wish to show that the university is the prophet of this democracy, and also its priest, and also its philosopher, and its deliverer. Like university is the Messiah, basically, is what he's saying. Now contrast that language to what you're hearing today from university administrators in terms of the message that they're expressing to the public.
Well, they're trying to sell the university in terms of return on investment for a higher salary than if you graduated from college. And that's important, and it's especially important for low-income people who are trying to get, you know, on the ladder and have a more stable job. It's really not a great country to be poor in, right? So I get that. That has to be there. But when you add up all of the benefits of university and include what the economist who's done this, Walter McMahon, calls the dark matter of the university, what you find is that the private market value of a higher salary is only one-third of the total cost. And the rest of it is private non-market benefits, you know, better health, better ability to adapt to new circumstances, et cetera. There's a lot of those. And then there's a lot of sort of public benefits, both direct and indirect, that is why it makes sense for the society as a whole to pay for the institution.
This gets to the question of the humanities, the so-called SASH fields, social sciences, arts, and humanities. But it's interesting. On one hand, you talk about Walter McMahon, sort of estimating the cash value of the social benefits of a bachelor's of arts degree, for example. But then later in the book, you also talk about how we need to get away from trying to find the, you know, measurable benefits of those kinds of things. Talk about those two points of view, if you would.
Yeah, okay. Well, the money stuff is pretty straightforward, and that's what we know about. And by the way, it still does pay to go to college.
Yeah, right.
It's, you know, it's 12 to 14% return on investment an economist at Ohio State named Matthew Mayhew has found. But what I'm really concerned about in the larger sense, and this is something that the humanities has always been great at, is thinking about personal development. You know, in religious context, we think about it as spiritual development, soul making, the forming of a soul. We used to talk in the 19th century university and college context about character development. There are a whole set of what we now kind of horribly call soft skills that are part of this. Judgment, active listening, levels of sympathy across lines of, you know, racial difference, differences of sexuality, differences of language, etc. And these are, you know, these are all things that the humanities as a whole developed set of techniques to help people not only understand in the abstract sense, but actually practice in their daily lives. I mean, a one word summary for it, you know, it's enrichment. And, you know, you asked me a few minutes ago about cultural shift, and, you know, there's another kind of answer to that question, which is that at some point the U.S. became materialistic in a way that I find very confusing. I don't quite know how that happened. I mean, it's always kind of been about money and about extraction and late great fortunes and that kind of thing. But it's also, it has a deep religious tradition. It has a deep democratic tradition. It has a deep kind of populist set of social justice traditions as well that have been very important. Racial egalitarianism, the labor movement, all these things have coexisted in this, you know, big kind of disorganized, kind of wonderful, energetic country. And they've been narrowed down to financial gain in a way that I don't think actually reflects what people want out of their lives. So one of the things that the university does is just offer an opening, right? It's a kind of a gesture of an open hand to the folks that enter, whether they're student age or older, it doesn't really matter, to say, you know, we are here to answer questions that you have both about the world, because we're here to offer organized knowledge about that. Mm-hmm. And we are also here to, you know, help you find answers to questions about who you are and what you need to do and what your place is in the world. And it's just, I mean, these are such fundamental human existential questions. And we're starting to belittle them in a way that I think, you know, shrinks the potential of the country and also just, you know, lowers the quality of life that we have. So I see the university as very much the counter to that. And when I say university, I don't just mean Berkeley, right, or my campus, Santa Barbara or Duke. I mean Danza Community College. I mean Santa Barbara City College. I mean, you know, every local school that has students and teachers that come together to experience learning together, you know, to practice it, to structure it, and to move forward. I think it should be a universally accessible thing in our society. And this is the thing that university leaders are not talking about enough. What about all the non-college people, and how do we bring them in, and how do we do enrichment with them, not just job training, but the whole high-quality thing that we automatically give to people that get into Princeton and the University of Michigan? Mm. That should be out there everywhere in every county of the United States.
So how do you explain, if you can at this point, how it is we've come to think about, focus on economic gain? Is there a political dimension to this that might explain it? Is there something ideological about the fact that we think like that these days?
Well, I think that the U.S. lost a lot of confidence at the policy level during the Vietnam War period. We also had this kind of automatic economic advantage in the 1945 to 75 period, and then our economic competitors and our former adversaries in World War II came back online, you know, Germany and Japan in particular. So everybody's back on their feet. It just becomes harder to make a buck, and there's a lot of, I think, anxiety about that. Looking to, you know, Japanese management techniques in the 70s and 80s is just one of many, many examples of the U.S. kind of thinking, well, maybe our model isn't the best and the only model. And I think that was a very fruitful process. It led to all sorts of, you know, continuation of various social movements that I admire, to the environmental movement. The feminist movement continued in this period of what kind of society do we want to be. And then I think it got narrowed in the 90s into sort of technology and return on investment visions of what the U.S. was about. And I think I think this is bipartisan. I think the Clintons were as involved in this, even though personally they may not have been, you know, only thinking about money, as any pro-business Republican would be. You know, it was a loss of of self-questioning and of, you know, an interest in the sort of the multiple missions that the country had. So I guess what I see now is that we're kind of split between Christianity and capitalism, right? It's just there's a lot of meaning that's provided by people's religious life, and there's a lot of meaning that's provided by people's business lives, not always positively in either case, really. But, you know, because there's fear in both of those traditions as well. And what's in the middle, or what's, you know, what are the other options? You know, what are the, you know, what about the artistic life of the community, or the, you know, just the community life itself? And that is getting shortchanged in a way that I think we need our educational institutions to be part of fixing.
Christopher Newfield is with us. He's an English literature professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book is called The Great Mistake: How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. We'll take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the scholar Christopher Newfield. He's an English literature professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're talking about his latest book. He's written a number of books on this subject. His latest is called The Great Mistake: How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. He's also written Unmaking the Public University and Ivy in Industry, Business in the Making of the American University. He's joining us from the studios of the BBC in London. He's there conducting research. One of the things we talked about a few minutes ago was how, as you say in the book, public universities have lost their ability to explain their social benefits. And I wonder if you think some of that may have to do with the reputation of the university among conservatives and even some moderates today. I mean, these perceptions of universities, maybe not all public universities, but certainly some private universities, as being these liberal bastions, intolerant lately of political diversity or free speech. I'm wondering where you think that may fit into this conversation.
Well, you know, people have really been focusing on kind of downshouting a couple of incidents of that I don't think are particularly representative of what actually goes on. You know, this incident, I'm amazed we haven't talked about Middlebury yet, because that, you know, that's produced this, I mean, some really nutty commentary, like the Yale law professor Stephen Carter writing in Bloomsbury saying that if authoritarian takes over America, you'll know that it did not come from a political party, but from a college campus,
yeah.
Which I just think is quite wrong. I think it's important to understand this concept of, you know, sort of political correctness and, you know, mind control that allegedly comes from that in its historical context. It's the pressure against speech has historically come from conservatives on college campuses not wanting, you know, in the 1980s, for example, the diversification of the first year canonical literary survey course at Stanford. There was a huge ruckus about bringing in people like Toni Morrison. Yeah. So it has not traditionally really been progressives who have been censoring, you know, curricula or, you know, trying to control the items that are on a course syllabus. The second thing to say is it is not the case that students come into universities expecting not to be challenged or to never hear anything that offends them or upsets them. What's happening in universities is that people are coming and meeting others that are different from them, often for the first time, you know, because our communities are pretty segregated. A lot of students, unfortunately, too high a proportion, from my point of view, come from suburbs and they don't come from cities. And so they're also encountering themselves as well as other people for the first time as adults, you know, just to take the classic 18 to 22 year old group.
Right.
And so what they're learning to do is to confront other people actually respectfully and have grasped their arguments, understand what their position is. And so that's the first big task. And then the second task is to also figure out how to challenge powerful discourses that seem to be injurious to them. So in the book, there's a long list of things that I think that universities need to do in order to develop what I'm calling, for lack of a better phrase, creative capabilities, yeah. Right? We're not doing factory education. We're doing this creativity education. The last thing, the thing that we all have to get to, is being able to contest in an oppositional situation where you're talking to people who don't agree with you and in many cases hate your guts. Okay, so we're a society that is kind of in a pre-Civil War moment again, right, where massive distrust, red state, blue state, Democrats, Republicans become a weird kind of cultural rift that is much, you know, that goes very deep compared to actually the very common, the shared policies the parties have on economics and some other things. And we need these skills desperately. And I think that that's the best way to see what's going on in these contested spaces, is the practice of contestation as fundamental to democracy. And that includes anger, and that includes shouting people down. That includes, you know, real conflict and real hostility getting expressed and then getting worked out in some, you know, way that universities have to teach as along with, you know, science and math.
Why wouldn't democratic citizenship or self-development, these are some of the core missions you write about, why couldn't they be cultivated under a privatization model? I mean, what's the concept that keeps that from working very well in a university that's driven more by market forces than a broader public good?
Well, the first thing is that you lavish resources on the people who can pay, or the people who are selected for scholarships that allow them to pay, right? So the reality of the situation is of higher ed has become very hierarchical by investment per student. So, you know, the high status, highly prestigious universities are not simply the ones that are really hard to get into. They're also the ones that just invest enormously more. I mean, it's, you know, by a factor of 10 or 20 more per student than the community colleges or the regional state schools. So that's part of it. The other thing that can happen is that the culture changes from one of education and reciprocity to one of return on investment and customer satisfaction. And that can mean, in the simplest way, people not, you know, grading as hard, kind of pulling punches around because you don't want to upset the future donor, because a lot of your revenue stream is now depending on, you know, having a successful pecuniary relationship to the student and not simply an educational one. I think that it changes the complexity of student thought. It reduces that complexity as they begin to feel like customers, because they're looking at the courses that are going to give them that ROI, and not for the courses that are developing them intellectually. And here's a really crucial thing for, you know, sort of the creativity economy that we're trying to get students into. They're not thinking about all of the different disciplines that their brains have to be able to put together, including disciplines that don't seem to go together. So if you're an electrical engineering major and you're forced because of GE requirements to take an art history class and a history class, if you're just look, this is not engineering, I just got to get back to my engineering because I'm looking for that $90,000 a year job as soon as I graduate. Yeah. What, this is a waste of my time. That's wrong, because actually the skills that you're learning, the narratological skills, the writing skills, the historical analytical skills, the aesthetic skills about looking at a painting, the awareness of your own emotional life as you're looking at a painting. All those things are going to go into whatever it is that you do with engineering later on. And I am 30 years later still getting emails from the engineering students that I taught at Cornell as a graduate student wow. saying, thank you for forcing me yeah. to write the third draft of that third paper because it has made a difference. So those things just get diminished as we privatize not just the money streams, but the culture and the ethos and the relationships that we have with each other.
I have to say, it seems like this was one of the principal insights, at least for me, this idea that when you make economic pressure, you know, that principal driving force for college students, that it limits their possibilities. And it undermines their ability to develop these special capabilities, which may not make any practical sense, at least if you just look in the short term. But as you said, in the long term, they have really profound benefits. Maybe it's just that we're too short-sighted about all of that.
Yeah, it's just we have a kind of an anxiety about, I think, our place in history and in the world. And we're not handling it by increasing our ambition. We're narrowing our ambition, and I think that's a huge mistake for the country as a whole, not just for the university system.
How do you explain student debt, massive, crazy student debt in this cycle?
Well, as the effect of over-reliance on private revenue. So there's this decline cycle that goes through eight steps, because I am trying to explain a certain kind of causality in this overall system in the book. So it starts with the retreat from the public good understanding of the university, which would have required that leaders in public universities especially focus intently on maintaining their public revenue streams through all of the ups and downs and make passionate, you know, angry arguments with legislators to maintain it on the grounds that this public money really does something different from all the private. So when we retreat from that, when public seems lower status, when it seems inefficient and so on, and we start looking towards private revenue streams, what happens is that we bring in relationships that actually cost the university a lot of money. It's not free money.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about increasing extramurally sponsored research, right? It's just research collaborations with outside people. I'm talking about fundraising, which also costs money.
And there's, because I mean, of that's the overhead. Because of the overhead, right? I mean,
yeah.
The people, they give this money and they think it's not free money because we have to administer these things. We have to write grants for these things. There's a ton of overhead associated with that stuff.
Yeah, and a simple example is with the wealthiest, the university isn't really hurt by this. So Phil Knight, who's the billionaire proprietor of Nike, gives $350 million to Stanford University to start Knight-Hennessy fellowships that are supposed to be like Rhodes scholarships at Oxford.
Yeah.
The first thing that happens is that Stanford then pledges $350 million of its own money as a match. So although the name on the fellowship is Knight-Hennessy, there's a huge expense incurred by a university in order to make that donation active. Mm. And there are other examples of the book for public universities where it's really damaging because we just really don't have the money anymore to float these deals. Here's the other thing about business culture. If you're in business, you are trying to make money from other people. You're not trying to help other people make money from you. So if I'm Intel and I'm going to the College of Engineering at UC Irvine, because I really like a couple of their researchers, my goal is not to just gift a bunch of stuff and get less out of it than I put in. My goal as a businessman is to get more out of it than I put in. I mean, that's just how business works.
Right.
So the universities are on the short end of that stick because they are dealing with people who are in a for-profit business who are obligated to make profits.
Yeah.
So the book is saying, look, this is bad for students and it's bad for research. I care a lot about STEM research, so I'm not saying we should do less STEM research because it's the villain here because it costs universities money. It's we got to figure out how we can do more STEM research by not having it bankrupt universities because of the overhead that you just mentioned. That's a piece of this, but yeah. The thing that I want people to take away from the book is that This privatization model is not working on its own terms. I mean, even if you take out what it's doing to researchers and what it's doing to students, which is basically making their lives harder and in the long run lowering their learning and their research output. Even if you take that out of the equation, there's a third problem, which is it's not even stabilizing the revenues of the university that's supposed to help.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a subsidy model for the people who are on the outside. So why does college cost so much? Well, it's because we're running losses in order to compete with each other for external revenue streams that don't cover the full cost and that require us to cough up also. And so that means private universities have been raising tuition as quickly as public, the other way around, publics as fast as privates for decades. And this predates the cuts that the legislature have been implementing that have made everything worse.
We're running out of time, and I want to get to the recovery cycle that you recommend. It has a number of points. You have these great cycles, and you sort of take us through these things, and there are these various stages. I really recommend people reading the book because it takes you through these sort of stages of development to get to another, where you want to end up. And number one, though, is that the university needs to be recognized as a public good. But then let me just mention let me go through these, actually, some of these, because I think they're fascinating. Number three, you say tuition then would be capped and then reduced toward zero. Public funding reset to replace tuition. Now, what are the costs associated with that? You do acknowledge there's a cost here. And how does that fit into the scheme of things? Like, how much is this going to cost us to get back on track?
About $48. Seriously, not very much money.
Yeah.
No, that's an allusion to a study that a group that I'm involved with did called Reclaim the California Master Plan. And it's just for the state. And what we calculated is that if we reset public funding up to 2000 levels for all three systems in California, which have combined, somewhere between, 2 and 2.5 million students. It's huge systems, these three systems. And then we reduced tuition to zero. The median taxpayer in California would pay $48 a year in extra income tax. It's higher at higher levels, but the regular person would pay not very much. Or let's take debt. Like, what if we say, okay, we can't start with free college, like Bernie Sanders was suggesting, and that Hillary Clinton started to agree with also.
Right.
We can't start with that. That's too scary, and it maybe there's moral hazards, and we don't want kids just to get it for nothing, et cetera. There's all sorts of concerns about this. So what if we just start with zero debt? My calculation suggests that it would cost about $200 billion a year. It's a ton of money, except when you consider the fact that that's exactly the amount of money we are currently spending on our broken financial aid system to produce over $1 trillion in accumulated debt. So, we can structure a system that costs $200 billion to get to zero, or structure a system that costs $200 billion a year to get to this crazy thing that we have now. And I would suggest, door number one, it will cut the financial industry out. I mean, that's a real issue. But it would be a process of deprivatization in the sense of backing the costs that the private sector model injects into education, even as there are things that we learn from the private sector about, certain kinds of process efficiencies and accounting and that kind of thing. It's not nothing.
Yeah.
But the deprivatization would lower costs, and the first cost that needs to be lowered is the cost of debt for students.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. President Trump's initial budget, he's proposing to cut or phase out federal funding we're in the middle of a fund drive, and we have this clearly on our minds these days. He's proposing to phase out federal funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for the National Endowment for the Arts, for the National Endowment for the Humanities. I'm wondering, does your broader message in your book apply to the arts and humanities as well as for public universities? And does this give you a sense of where, how difficult, whether or not we have the political will to do some of the things that you recommend in your books?
I think that when we understand the effects of not acting, we will have the political will to do it, to act. I'm pretty confident. That's just that we don't understand it now. And we, 30, 40 years have just suggested you can basically fix everything by marketizing it. And the book is showing this for the sector that I know well. I would make the same argument for healthcare, right? It's just having these intermediaries has really not lowered the cost. It's massively increased the cost. And the same goes for the arts and the humanities, for radio, about which I care quite a bit, and which most people, it saved their lives during commuting. And there's what markets do is they norm to the lowest common denominator. They norm to mass, consumption. And so there are certain areas like television that have managed to sort of segment in a way where you can have a kind of a pretty good diversity and pretty high quality. It doesn't work with ballet. It doesn't when you already have small markets. You need to have the society paying for something that the overall society benefits from, even if a tiny fraction, the long tail, the little people, the few people, are the primary beneficiaries of that. And most countries understand this, and it's, we've been sold a bill of goods that you can basically make everything better and more efficient and cheaper by putting it on a pay, get what you pay for model. And it just doesn't work that way because you lose a whole bunch of things that you basically really want. And you don't even know how much you want them until they're gone. And I really don't want that to happen to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and for, all the other already underfunded, enrichment and pleasure activities that we need in order to stay sane as a society and also in order to be smart as a society.
It's Christopher Newfield. His new book is called The Great Mistake, How We Wrecked Public Universities and How We Can Fix Them. Joined us today from the studios of the BBC in London. Professor Newfield, thank you very much for taking the time.
Doug, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Adrian Moranville. David Boyle is our intern. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.